Welcome back to Exploring Jewish Thought with Aharoni Schlesinger. Today, we're going to take a look at Olam Haba, the afterlife, through the eyes of the Ramban. So I think it's very interesting. The afterlife is definitely a concept that engenders a lot of thought and debate. A lot of people seem to be anticipating the afterlife, theorizing about the afterlife. Everyone wants their Shlish Gan Eden or whatever it is. It's what a lot of people feel like they're working towards. And yet, I know very few people who have a source-based perception of what the afterlife actually is or what it would look like. So there are a number of different approaches that can be probably broken down to the, Ramban's very Kabbalistic approach, the Rambam's more rationalist approach, obviously overgeneralizations of each of those approaches. But we're going to take a look at the Ramban's today and try to understand step by step just a little bit more about the concept of the afterlife. What's Olam Haba? What's Gan Eden? What exactly is that experience? What do we know about it through their assessment? So first of all, let's begin with the concept of death, which is essentially what most would agree with would be the separation of the soul from the body. The life as we know it is really a union of the body and soul. The model for this is Adam Arishon, who was first created out of earth and then given the breath of God, which was his divine inspiration. And when you die, you essentially become just the body left on earth, and your identity is, contained entirely within this soul. And then the nature or what the experience of the soul beyond that is really going to be our main point of exploration today. If you're interested in looking up the sources and going a little bit more in depth on this topic, I would highly recommend Rabbi Wiederblank's Illuminating Jewish Thought. It's a Magid series published book, and it really goes in depth on this topic, bringing a lot of sources inside. I found it very helpful when doing this exploration on the topic for my own. According to the Ramban, there are really three distinct time periods. The first of which is Olam Hazeh, and that is the Olam Hazeh is kind of what we refer to as the physical world that we know of today, but it's also a time period, the first of which, the 6,000-year time period that we exist in is Olam Hazeh, and within the same time period exists what's called the Olam HaNishamot, where this world is where the living beings, the union of body and soul exist. And after death, the neshama goes to the Olam HaNishamot. The Olam HaNishamot is for this period of history what we would refer to as the afterlife. It is where the neshama goes when it separates from the body. The Olam HaNishamot really breaks up into two places, two categories, which is Gan Eden and Gehenim. Gan Eden being the paradigmatic heaven, and Gan Eden and Gehenim being hell. Then you have the second phase of history, which is Yemot HaMashiach. Now, Yemot HaMashiach, while in the Ramban's view, is very different than the world we know it to be today, it is still in this world. It is in this world, but nature is a little bit different. How we understand the world to work is a little bit different. There are a lot of changes in Yemot HaMashiach, but it is still in this world proper. It is in the physical world as we know it. And then there's a third time in history, which is Olam Haba. So Olam Haba is not this place, whether physical or spiritual, that we go to after we die. It's rather the third phase of history. Olam Hazeh being today, being our time period, and in our time period, in our point within history, those who die go to Olam HaNishamot, which is in the same time period as Olam Hazeh. Yemot HaMashiach is a distinct time period in history. And then you have Olam Haba, which is a third time period within history. That's how he breaks them down. So what that means is Gan Eden is very different than Olam Haba, according to the Ramban. In fact, they don't even exist within the same time frame. And they're not just two different places or two metaphysical places, but they're two different times entirely with two different goals. They're two different experiences altogether. Okay. The Yemot HaMashiach is essentially the next stage after Olam Hazeh, which is what we're familiar with. Yemot HaMashiach is in this world, and there is a Techiyat HaMetim for Yimot HaMashiach. The Tchiyat HaMetim for Yimot HaMashiach, however, exists only for tzaddikim. So those who are righteous, who merit it, are rewarded by being allowed to be to participate in this idyllic existence within our world known as Yimot HaMashiach. Yimot HaMashiach is this is unbelievable time where Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence, where God's presence is in this world. This is the Messianic era. This is the time where God is clear to the entire world. This is a time where faith and religion is clear to the entire world. This is the time when the service of God is universally valued and is existing in basically its highest form possible in this universe. There is no war or aggression. The aggressive nature, violent nature of all things really ceases to exist, and we can see the world functioning in its ideally intended state. The righteous of our past will get resurrected, and they get to experience this wondrous state of being in this world, which is Yimot HaMashiach. Then Olam Haba has not yet been created, whereas Yimot HaMashiach is a time period within this world where nature functions a little bit differently. Olam Haba, the world to come, has not yet been created. It will be created in its proper time. So after Yimot HaMashiach, that's when Olam Haba starts. And at least all Jews get to experience it, or those who are worthy, and all Jews get to experience it, as the Talmud and Tractate Sanhedrin says that Kol Yisrael Yeshalim Chelek Olam Haba, all of Israel has a portion in the world to come. And this is what it was talking about, not Yimot HaMashiach, not the Messianic era, rather Olam Haba, all Jews get to experience. And this goes on forever, and it is the greatest fathomable interaction with God that we could ever experience. We don't exactly know exactly what that looks like, or what that will be, or what the experience will be, but it is the closest interaction that that any part of our being gets to experience with regard to their relationship to God. Now, what that means is that, according to the Ramban, there are basically two separate resurrections, right? There is the Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, that comes before Yimot HaMashiach, which exists for the tzaddikim, only the righteous among us. And then there's a second resurrection that is a mass resurrection, which is the resurrection before Olam Haba. Now, there is a debate around the tzaddikim, the righteous people, whether Olam Haba is, or whether they stay alive from Yimot HaMashiach until Olam Haba, or whether they could die like normal human beings die, even in a time known as Yimot HaMashiach, the Messianic era, and then they are again included in the mass resurrection before Olam Haba. But either way, there are two distinct resurrections in the Ramban's understanding of the afterlife and what happens after you die. Now, the implication of there being a mass resurrection before Olam Haba is very interesting, because for Olam Haba not to be a place that the soul travels to after death while the rest of the world continues to exist, but to be a distinct time period in history that there is a resurrection for, meaning you need to be resurrected to go to Olam Haba, the question is that would seem to imply that people will exist with their physical bodies in Olam Haba, right? If you only need your soul to benefit from the world to come, from Olam Haba, that would be understandable. But if you have to be resurrected for Olam Haba, that would seem to mean that there's going to be an eventual union, or reunion rather, of the body and the soul to participate in Olam Haba, to be a part of Olam Haba, and we have a body for Olam Haba. So we have to understand how the Ramban knows this, because it's, in a sense, it's counterintuitive, though it's hard, I guess, to define what is intuitive, the degree to which you can have any sort of intuition for something as abstract as the world to come is hard to say But it would seem to be counterintuitive that an existence that is entirely spiritual and an experience defined as the closest possible interaction that we as beings can have with God, it's hard to understand why the body in that situation would be of any function or necessity. And the second one it would be how the Ramban really knows this, where he gets it from, and then how does that make sense? How do we understand the necessity or the function that the body will play eventually in the world to come? So, first of all, we understand that there is a precedent. There is certainly a concept of eternal life in human form, with bodily functions. We see that from Adam and Chava. See, Adam and Chava did not live forever. However, it's clear in Bereshit that had they eaten from the Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life, they would have lived forever, but they are in human form. So there is this concept that exists of, at least in the written tradition, in the written Torah, there is a concept that exists of an eternal existence for human beings, namely Adam and Chava, who had they eaten from the tree of knowledge, from the tree of life, rather than the tree of knowledge, they would have existed forever as they were human beings in human form, just eternally, which is a fascinating concept. So the Ramban does not create this idea that there would be some sort of significance to eternal existence in human form. And even for that to be an ideal, the ideal existence of the ideal existence of our being an eternal existence in human form seems to be implicit from Bereshit. So the Ramban certainly does not make that up. Furthermore, whenever you discuss Kabbalistic concepts, you know, Kabbalah, as its name would indicate, are traditions that were received from previous generations. This is his Mesorah. He received it from his teachers or understood it from the principles that they gave him, that this is essentially what the afterlife is, and there's some function to the body. But lastly, there is a Gemara that would seem to indicate this as well, and that is the Gemara seems to equate the Olam Haba with resurrection, Techiyat HaMeitim with Olam Haba, when it lists things that would render someone unfit for the world to come. And it says that someone who denies the idea of Techiyat HaMeitim, someone who denies the idea of resurrection, first of all, they're a heretic, and as such, they are unfit for the world to come. They don't merit the world to come. And in explaining the logic of someone denying the Tchiyat HaMeitim, denying resurrection, and therefore being unfit to the world for the world to come, well, it's a very interesting concept when you think about it, because you're not denying God. You're not denying his supremacy. You're not denying the Torah. There's so many things that you're not denying. In fact, Tchiyat HaMeitim is not written in the Torah, and it seems to be that you accept all the necessary ideas in order to exist properly and appropriately and spiritually in this world, in all aspects of service of God and all aspects of Tikkun Olam. Really, everything you believe in, everything that you need to believe in to be a perfect servant of God. And yet, the fact that you don't believe that at some point in time, the dead will be resurrected renders you unfit to participate in the world to come, which is a very interesting concept and could be discussed, you know, at greater length. But just to mention how the Gemara puts it, it says, because you denied in it, you don't deserve it. Because you denied it, you don't deserve to be a part of it. Which would mean that it's the same it that we're referring to, right? Because you denied the world, because you denied resurrection of the dead, you don't deserve to be a part of the resurrection of the dead. But you didn't deny, but you're not being a part of resurrection of the dead, you're not being a part of Olam Haba. It would seem to indicate from this Gemara that the two are one and the same. And that participation in Olam Haba is the same thing as the resurrection of the dead. So, if you deny the idea of Tchiyat HaMeitim, that the dead will eventually come back to life, you will not be among those who come back to life to experience Olam Haba. Olam Haba is the experience of those who come back to life, and you do not get to be a part of that. So that's a very interesting implication of the Gemara, that all these serve to prove or support the Ramban's position that there is a physical body that will exist even in Olam Haba, the eternal world to come, that will be experienced by all who deserve it. And number two is just understanding Understanding what exactly it means that you have a body, because Olam Haba is a purely spiritual existence in a sense. There's no eating, there's no drinking, there's no physical pleasures of any kind. Now, we do have examples such as Moshe Rabbeinu, who spent 40 days without eating or drinking of any kind on Har Sinai. So, I mean, we don't believe that he lost all physical form. He obviously came down with the body he went up with. So it is possible for under certain, I guess, spiritual conditions for the body to exist without any necessity for the sustenance that it normally derives benefit from. Perhaps all sustenance that it receives would be from the soul, which also would explain or would give us a better understanding of how it could be that it's eternal. The soul is eternal, it's a part of God, and God is eternal, so the soul is eternal, but the body is very much not eternal. The body is physical, it can be worn down over time, and therefore it's hard to wrap our minds around this idea that the body could be part of an eternal existence like the soul could. So the body in Olam Haba would seem to have an expiration date, but not if we understand that the body really derives all of its sustenance from the soul, and perhaps the eternal nature of the soul gives the body an eternal nature as well. The body ceases to need any of its physical necessities that we have in this world, yet the body continues to exist in some form. And so what the Ramban writes is very interesting. He writes that as far as the relationship between body and soul goes, while they're generally the body, its interests, its needs, its being is in opposition to those of the soul, we have basically a struggle in this world to subdue the desires and the needs of the body for the sake of the pursuits of the soul. But extremely righteous people, says the Ramban, can really succeed. Can ultimately succeed in that mission, not just temporarily subduing the desires of the body for the pursuits of the soul, but ultimately defeating the desires of the body and the impulses of the body for the pursuits of the soul. That's kind of something that we see by let's say Eliyahu HaNavi, who does not actually, Eliyahu ascends to Shemayim in Sefer Malachim, he ascends to Shemayim completely intact, body and soul. Perhaps he is one of these people who goes up as an entire body because he doesn't need to be stripped of his body because he had completely subdued it to the desires of the soul. It's only when the body is holding the soul back from its pursuits does it need to have this separation period in the Olam HaNeshamot. But if the body ceases to be an oppositional force to the soul, then that might not be necessary. Now, that is for the greatest of the great. You know, even the righteous people that we're familiar with did not have that same experience as Eliyahu, right? It's for the greatest of the great. But what about those who don't achieve that level where their body is completely subdued by the pursuits of the soul, no longer serve as a hindrance of any kind in its pursuits? So that's really where Gan Eden and Gehenna come in. That Gan Eden is essentially the purification or the preparation, rather of the soul, the preparation of the soul in order for the preparation of the soul for the reunion with the body, so that the nature can be appropriate for the existence of Olam Haba. And that's essentially what what Gan Eden and Gehenna, as we'll discuss, is going to come to facilitate. Because the relationship between our body and soul is not one that would allow us to exist properly in Olam Haba, body and soul together. Their relationship is off. Their functionality is off. The body has too much say and too much influence on the soul. But the experience of Gan Eden and Gehenna are designed to correct that the nature of that relationship by its influence on the soul, and for their ultimate reunion to be one that is a proper union for the purposes of existing in Olam Haba. Now, we also need to understand that, meaning, why do we need all of this? Why do we need that relationship at all? Just let the soul, the entirely spiritual part of us, experience it on its own. And that really comes from, that perception is going to come from, I guess, a fundamental idea that the body is all physical. That the only spiritual, the only godly significant part about us is the soul, is the neshama that God put into an entirely physical being. And that is an idea that the more Kabbalistic thinkers, like the Ramban, like the Maharal, take issue with. They believe that the body is of divine significance as well. It is not of spiritual character. It's not of spiritual composition. It's not a part of God as the soul is, but it is clearly of divine significance. It is not just the physical shell that is hosting the godly component of us, but a divinely designed physical form with tremendous significance beyond just being the host of the soul itself. If you look at, you could perhaps understand that from the verses in Bereishit that speak about creating Adam. God says that He's going to create Adam in His image and in His likeness. And you have to ask what exactly that means. For Adam to be created in His image and in His likeness, it would seem to imply that even His physical form, meaning it wasn't that God constructed Adam's physical form and then said, and I'm going to make this physical form in My likeness and in My image by giving him a neshama. He seems to be constructed entirely in God's likeness and His image. I have to explain, understand some more difficult concepts in terms of understanding how exactly a physical being is any sort of resemblance of God is a little bit difficult and not entirely our topic. And the only reason that I bring it up is just to suggest that the body seems to have been constructed in God's image and it is not only the soul that is of godly significance. The body itself is a reflection of the spiritual character of man. We are not just an animal with a neshama. We are a godly physical creation with the divine inspiration of the soul. And that would be the position that the Ramban maintains. And though we may not understand the exact purpose of the body for Olam Haba, what its function may be, just by understanding that the body is of a greater significance than just the physical host of our soul, just by understanding that we are not animals with a neshama, that even our physical form is of divine significance, we can understand that the body does not become an entirely irrelevant feature when it comes to the world to come. Rather, it just loses its necessity for some of the more base physical animalistic benefits of this world, and just serves its function with no physical requirements, feeding entirely off the energy of the soul itself. And that is the understanding of why the body may be necessary, more necessary than we once thought for Olam Haba, the world to come. Now we have to understand a little bit about. So that's just kind of what we know. Or what the Ramban believes in terms of the sequence of events, who gets to participate, and when everything is happening. But now I want to talk a little bit more about what the experience actually is, which is a realm that, of course, this needs to be said. I'm sure I've said this multiple times throughout this podcast, and it needs to be stated probably 100 more times, which is we don't know with 100% certainty, nor with, you know, we don't know conclusively what will be and what will not be. We'll never be able to paint an exact detailed picture of these concepts, especially in dealing with some of our previous topics like why God created the world and the purpose of mitzvot. We are doing our best to wrap our minds around these ideas. There will always be the bulk of the content that is really just beyond us. So to the extent to which we can understand these concepts and conceptualize the experience, I would like to delve into what the experience of Gan Eden is. So the experience of Gan Eden is very interesting, and there's also, we have to understand, does it have anything to do with the Gan Eden that Adam and Chava were placed in? In that case, does that imply that Gan Eden is an actual physical location, or is it only a spiritual location? If it's physical, what are the neshamas doing there? So essentially, the Ramban's position is a very fascinating one, and that's as follows. And that the Ran, really, in the Drashot HaRan, helps us understand exactly what the conditions are that help us or lend support to the Ramban's position, which is that after somebody's death, the neshama does not return entirely to its previous nature as really being a part of God. The neshama was impacted from its experience in the physical world, and it is a fundamentally spiritual being or entity with some physical properties that were affected by its time in the body, in the physical world. Kind of how we may look at people as physical beings who are divinely inspired. Well, now the neshama is a spiritual being that's physically, I don't want to say inspired, but I also don't want to say tainted, but influenced, impacted by physicality. That point can be used to understand some of the practices and traditions that we have today in terms of our understanding of the link between the soul and the body that once hosted it. It's interesting, there's a practice, we just had Lag BaOmer, there's a practice that most years people have to go to the kever of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Some people like to daven at the Kivrei Tzadikim, specifically perhaps the kever of the grave of the righteous, the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. People like to daven there. And leaving that topic aside in terms of its implications and what you should and shouldn't be saying there, it's interesting because if you understand, meaning what significance does the burial place of a righteous person hold? It is just dirt that is harboring a coffin that once held a physical form occupied by a soul that is now somewhere else entirely. So, meaning, if you want to connect to the righteous people as a means of connecting to God, first of all, do so in an appropriate manner, because there are certainly inappropriate ways to do so. But second of all, you should be able to do that anywhere, or if you believe the soul is in, you know, one physical or quasi-physical place, why does that have anything to do with the place that it was buried, unless the soul itself maintains some sort of connection with the body that it once that once hosted it? And so the soul does not go exactly to the heavens in an entirely spiritual realm. It doesn't entirely return to God and reunite as a part of God. Rather, it stays in this. Somewhat spiritual, but somewhat physically linked place. And that is why Gan Eden is the perfect host for the soul. Because Gan Eden is just that. It is this place that we understand to be physical to a certain degree with spiritual properties, or spiritual to a certain degree with physical properties. Is it an actual location? We do know that human beings were placed there. Maybe that implies that it's a location. We've never found Gan Eden. It sounds like some sort of paradise of sorts. And so that's why it makes perfect sense what the Ran is saying, that if the soul was this ideally once entirely spiritual existence that was impacted by its occupation of the body to be of physical properties to a certain degree, then its resting place or its natural home or natural comfort zone would be, or the place that it is bound to in nature would be a place that is of a similar nature, which is somewhat perhaps ideally spiritual but imbued with physical properties. And the Ramban understands Gan Eden as just that. They're really, in a sense, two Gan Edens. There is a physical Gan Eden where not two Gan Edens, but two ideas of Gan Eden. The physical Gan Eden that Adam and Chava existed in, was a physical place, perhaps is a physical place in this world. And the what made Gan Eden, the physical Gan Eden, special is that it was the optimal situation. It was the optimal environment for human existence. Is what it was. You could live there eternally at peace with no issues whatsoever. It's optimal location for physical existence. That isn't just a part of it. That's what it was. It wasn't just Gan Eden is this really lovely place with all these things, and a big appeal to Gan Eden is that it is the optimal place for human existence. No, the very definition of Gan Eden is that it's the optimal place for human existence. It is Gan Eden to the extent to which it is the optimal place for human existence. Anything that is optimal for human existence is Gan Eden. It is the physical manifestation of what would be the ideal place to live. Right? That's what Gan Eden is, both in nature and in definition and in actuality. Now, what Gan Eden is in terms of the Olam HaNeshamot, the world of souls that our soul travels to after we die, is essentially this quasi-spiritual place modeled after the Shemayim. It's modeled after the Shemayim, or it emulates the Shemayim in a sense that it harbors all the divine truths of God, of existence, of the universe, but in somewhat of a more spiritual form, meaning what exists only as abstract concepts of truth and knowledge in the heavens, where a Kadosh Baruch Hu exists or reigns over, has a more not physical manifestation, but has a manifestation with which human beings can interact in the Gan Eden of the Olam HaNeshamot, right? It is all the truth of the heavens. It is the truth of God. It is the truth of the world. It is the truth of being and existence itself. It is all the truth of the heavens, but conveyed in a manner that our being can interact with. So it is this, it is not quite the heavens, but it's not quite the earth. It is some middle ground that our soul, which is also some middle ground existence, in that it was an originally spiritual idea that was given physical properties through its existence in this world, can interact, because Gan Eden too is a not quite physical but not quite entirely spiritual environment. And the Gan Eden, the truths of the heavens are wrapped up in the idea of the physical Gan Eden, which is the optimal place for existence in this quasi-physical, quasi-spiritual realm known as the Gan Eden of the Olam HaNeshamot. And that's essentially what Gan Eden is, right? It is Gan Eden that we know of from Bereishit, in that that is how it looks. That is its manifestation to the soul, because it's the optimal place for our existence. To that degree, it is Gan Eden, but it is very different than Gan Eden in the sense that all of the reality of Gan Eden are just manifestations of a divine truth in a way that may be experienced by the soul in its current state. That essentially is what Gan Eden is. Now, the purpose of having those truths there and giving the deceased, these souls, the opportunity to interact with that truth is very fascinating. And from here, I think we're going to start to see what was, when I came across it, perhaps one of the most profoundly, apparently true, undiluted forms of absolute truth that I've ever encountered. I read these ideas, and they just seemed to make so many concepts that I and we are familiar with from so many different places make absolute perfect sense, that it is something that is just, that I'm sure is so profoundly true. And I want to get into what exactly I mean by that. Gan Eden is essentially, in essence, an intellectual endeavor. It is an existence that is most conducive for intellectual development, the achievement of the knowledge of absolute truth in its purest form. It is the opportunity for our souls to learn everything there is to learn about reality in the absolute optimal way. It is the most that we could ever know in the clearest fashion, similar to what Moshe Rabbeinu apparently learned on Har Sinai. And it is not random that our sages linked Gan Eden, or suggested perhaps that the physical location of Gan Eden was located none other than in Bavel. While this may come as a shock that Bavel, a place in the exile, not in Israel, is the place of Gan Eden, or the physical location associated with Gan Eden, really it makes perfect sense. Because Bavel is a location, Babylonia is the location that clearly marks the Jewish nation's discovery of God through intellectual means. That is what Bavel was, being the home, the location of the development of the oral law through analytical, logical, and intellectual means. Bavel was the pursuit of God through the intellect. And I think that's very, very fascinating to think about, because essentially what they were trying to do in Bavel through clarifying the oral tradition was piecing back together experiences that they had, that the nation had, in a more all-encompassing sense in Israel. See, when they were trying to determine the specific laws that pertain to holidays, that pertain to various mitzvot, commandments, practices, different methods of service of God, they were essentially trying to piece together through analysis what was once experienced through their being. And that experience happened in Yerushalayim, right? Happened in Jerusalem and in Israel, but more specifically in Jerusalem, around the temple, around the Beit HaMikdash, which is just a fascinating concept that in Bavel, they were trying to identify God through the intellect and rediscover what was once experienced with the entire being, rediscover an emotional experience that the Jewish people once had actively using only the mind. And that is what the clarification of the oral tradition was. And it's very fascinating because that also occurred at a time when we lost prophecy. And that is also that also explains this link that exists between knowledge and prophecy, between the two paths or modes that God can be discovered, which is through logical analysis or through revelation, right? Nevuah is revelation, and it is experienced with the senses, right? It is an emotional almost experience of closeness with God, whereas chokhmah, knowledge, is learning about God and experienced in the mind. And then it stands to reason that Bavel is the center of chokhmah, of knowledge, of analysis, whereas Yerushalayim is the center of nevuah. Right? The sages tell us in the Talmud that all prophecies could either only be in Israel or about Israel. So that's not random, and that's because Israel is the physical location most closely associated with the emotional experience of God, as opposed to the intellectual pursuit of God, which we can see through our history took place in Babel. Now, what that means is as follows. What that means is that the sages identified Babel as the physical location most conducive to the intellectual pursuit of God, or rather, history proved that Babel was the physical location most conducive to the pursuit of God, and so it is not random that the sages identified Babel with as the location where Gan Eden could be found, because the spiritual or the more spiritual version of Gan Eden is the opportunity that our souls have to discover God intellectually, discover the knowledge of God and the truth of all existence, but it is an intellectual pursuit fitting of Babel, and therefore, although it is the optimal intellectual pursuit, the highest degree of knowledge that human beings could ever achieve, it is qualitatively Bavli. It is qualitatively similar to Babel, in that Babel is not the holistic, all-encompassing emotional experience of God, just the intellectual pursuit of God. That is what Gan Eden is on the highest level, and that is what Babel is on the strictly physical level. And therefore, it would make sense that Yerushalayim is not the place for Gan Eden. Yerushalayim is a place of a more all-encompassing emotional experience of God in the physical world, and perhaps, as we're about to see, the spiritual world as well. See, the Ramban brings down the following debate in understanding, in order to understand the relationship between the mind and the heart, or rather the brain and the heart, the mind and the emotions, in understanding God. And the debate was as to whether or not wisdom is from the mind or from the heart. And the conclusion of this debate, as the Ramban brings down, is that wisdom begins in the mind and ultimately spreads to the heart. And there is an explicit verse, an explicit pasuk that teaches us that, which is, open your ears. I'm translating, open your ears and hear the words of the wise, and your heart will be set to my knowledge, right? Which seems to indicate that the ears attached to the head, where the information goes through in order to reach the brain, is the starting place of wisdom. It is where wisdom is received, but the ultimate location that we hope that wisdom to go to is to our hearts. In which case, it would make sense that Babel, or rather that Gan Eden, is the intellectual, the somewhat spiritual intellectual pursuit of God through the truths of his being and through the universe, and they serve as only a preparation for Olam Haba, because the intellect is only the mind is only where wisdom begins. Ultimately, we hope that it spreads to the heart, and our ultimate goal is not just the knowledge of God in the mind, but the emotional experience of God through the heart. And that verse clearly indicates that this is the process that knowledge travels through, going first from the mind to the heart, and it is therefore the process that our spiritual being must travel through in order to truly experience God at the highest level. We must first have the absolute refinement of our knowledge of God in Babel or in Gan Eden. Now, this is not only the case for our ultimate spiritual pursuits, but this was first and foremost Well, this was beforehand. This was the case for the Jewish people as a nation altogether, because we needed, meaning we were, we had some sort of inappropriate interaction with God in the land of Israel during in the temple period. We can leave out what exactly that interaction was and why it was flawed, but we were not interacting with God properly in the best manner possible. And so if you're not having the proper emotional experience with God, what that may mean is that you lack the necessary intellectual understanding of God, in which case we were as a nation exiled to Babel to refine our knowledge of God, and the experience that we had in Babel, which was an intellectual pursuit that we were supposed to have, was ultimately going to facilitate our return to Israel for a more proper emotional experience with God. The intellectual pursuit of Babel was supposed to prepare us to return to Israel to have a more proper emotional interaction with God that must and is necessarily founded on the intellectual understanding of God to whatever degree possible in the physical world. That is the analysis that we see in the Talmud that was developed in Babel, and in the more abstract spiritual realm, that is the refinement that we receive through Gan Eden associated with Babel. And only then can we come back to Yerushalayim in order to properly experience God, not just with our minds, but with every fiber of our being, in a moralistic and all-encompassing emotional sense through everything that we do. Now, it's interesting that it really started before the Jewish people as a nation experienced this through the course of their history, but actually was founded by Avraham, who was instructed by God to travel from Babel to Eretz Yisrael, which also makes absolute perfect sense, because Avraham was such an interesting character. Unlike Adam, who was visited or who spoke to God directly, Noah, who was visited by God directly, Avraham first discovers God on his own through his own analysis of natural phenomena, right? He looks at the sun and assumes the sun, according to the Midrash. He looks at the sun, assumes that the sun is God, but then the sun goes down at night, and then he looks at the moon, assumes it's God, but the moon goes away. He looks to the things around him in order to perceive that there must be one God who controls everything, who is not bound by anything. He discovers God through his analysis, through logic, and then he is subsequently sent to Eretz Yisrael before he can start serving God, because the service of God is an all-encompassing emotional experience. It was not meant to be limited to just the intellect, but it was meant to be done with every fiber of the being and be a profound emotional experience. That is why, perhaps, I would like to suggest, it would stand to reason that going to Eretz Yisrael was the first commandment that Avraham, and by extension, the first commandment that a Jew ever received. And you might want to say there are commandments that may seem sensible to be the first commandment ever given to a Jew. Perhaps, you know, ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor like yourself, or don't kill, or don't serve other gods. All these things that seem so fundamental. How about any one of the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments? Those seem fundamental. No, the first commandment that Avraham receives is to go to Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because none of the other commandments make sense unless you're there. This is outside of Eretz Yisrael is simply not a place for emotional experiences of God that are the performance of mitzvot and the service of God. Those are only in Israel. That is what Israel is. Israel is the physical location that harbors the spiritual quality, which is the opportunity to connect to God through to experience God through emotional means. So it just nothing else that God was going to tell Abraham to do made any sense anywhere else. Because if Abraham was going, Abraham clearly achieved his mission in the logical discovery, the arrival at God, the pursuit of knowledge of godly wisdom outside of Eretz Yisrael. But if he was going to do anything, if he was going to serve God in any manner beyond with his intellect, if he was going to experience God in any sort of emotional sense, that must have been in Eretz Yisrael before God could tell him anything else. He told him to go to Israel. Nothing made sense anywhere else, which is very consistent with the Ramban's explanation of all mitzvot fundamentally only being relevant in the land of Israel. It's Vayikra, Yudchet, I believe it's chapter 18, verse 25, where the Ramban explains that the performance of mitzvot is simply, it's not relevant anywhere else outside of Eretz Yisrael. That's not to say you shouldn't do them. There's some sort of practice. That doesn't mean they're entirely not significant. That doesn't mean that they're absolutely nothing. But to a certain degree, it's simply not relevant. The mitzvot are not the mitzvot that we know them anywhere else, because the mitzvot which are designed to facilitate the interactions with God can only properly be done in a place that is conducive to interaction with God in an actual, emotional, all-encompassing sense. Anywhere else is just not a place that is conducive to such an experience. That's only in Eretz Yisrael. Abraham then went there first before he could start actually serving God in any real sense. So what we see is the experience of Avraham Avinu finding God through intellectual means, analyzing the things around him to arrive at God, were his preparation to being told to go to Israel in order to start serving God in an emotional, experiential sense through commandments. And that is a process that was mirrored by the Jewish nation in their exile to Bavel, to correct their experience in Israel. They had an intellectual pursuit of knowledge of God in Bavel, which was essentially they're piecing back together the experiences that they once had in Jerusalem, the place of experiential, emotional interaction with God. They had to piece things back together absolutely properly, but through logic and through analysis, only to then be allowed back to Eretz Yisrael now to experience the interaction with God in a more wholesome and emotional sense. The knowledge that they achieved, that they received in Bavel, was the preparation that they needed in order to experience service of God in Jerusalem properly. That was Bavel. That is, both Avraham and the Jewish nation conform perfectly to that verse, which says that that true wisdom starts at the mind and works its way into the heart. And ultimately, this is the experience not only that Avraham, the founder of the Jewish nation, and really the foundation for everything that the Jewish nation came to be, experienced. This is not only an experience that the Jewish nation had historically through the exile to Babel and the return to Eretz Yisrael. This is also an experience that every single individual soul must go through, which is its refinement through Gan Eden, through the optimal intellectual pursuit of God, the highest level of knowledge of God that is attainable to our being in Gan Eden, which is aimed to facilitate the pursuit of that knowledge. That is the preparation for Olam Haba. Now, Olam Haba, which it should be very obvious to us now, if Gan Eden was the spiritual manifestation of the intellectual pursuit of God found in Bavel, then Olam Haba is the greatest of the great, and it is the spiritual manifestation of the holistic experience, emotional encounter with God that you have in Yerushalayim. Olam Haba is the spiritual Yerushalayim. It is the Yerushalayim Shel Mala, the Jerusalem that exists in the upper domain. It rivals Gan Eden's intellectual pursuit that links it to Bavel. Olam Haba is the emotional experience, the emotional encounter with God that exists only in Yerushalayim. It is the Shar HaShamayim, the gateway to heaven itself. Olam Haba is essentially the Yerushalayim in essence, but the highest version that we can ever experience. It is the greatest degree that the soul can encounter God in an emotional and optimal fashion. It is the Yerushalayim Shel Mala, the Jerusalem of the upper domain. Now, just as a side point, we need to address in the process what Gehenim is, what hell is. Well, aside for perhaps certain outstanding individuals who can never properly be refined by basically what we would call the fires of hell, Gehenim is made to refine the soul that cannot get and in its current state what it needs to get from Gan Eden, where Gan Eden is the preparation of the soul for Olam Haba, the intellectual preparation before the emotional experience. Not every soul leaves the body ready for such an endeavor. Some souls leave the body so brutally misshapen and tainted by the misdeeds of the body itself that it is not at a place where it can pursue the purpose of Gan Eden, and that is where Gehenim comes in. Gehenim refines the soul through the fire, whatever exactly that means. It refines the character of the soul. It siphons out the bad. It refines the bad before the good can be properly developed enough to be ready for Olam Haba. That is the purpose of Gehenim. Gehenim, we say is a time that is, except for an exceptional few cases, a temporary experience ultimately designed to prepare for Gan Eden, because before you had been sur mera ve'ase tov, before you eliminate the bad that is preventing the pursuit of good, you cannot exist in Gan Eden properly. You go to Gehenim, you refine the bad characteristics that the bad nature that was received by the body's misdeeds in this world. Once that has been properly refined, you advance to Gan Eden, all existing within the Olam HaNishamot, what is currently going on for the souls of those who are deceased in our time period, parallel to our time period. You go on to Gan Eden to interact with the most direct, version of godly knowledge and godly wisdom that can be achieved by human souls or human minds. And that serves as the spiritual or the mindful preparation that the soul needs for its eventual reunion of the body to enter and be resurrected for Olam Haba, the world to come, which is going to be an unbelievable, unfathomable, holistic, emotional experience of God with every fiber of our being, that is basically the highest spiritual spiritual version of what service of God is at the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim in the physical realm. That is essentially how the Ramban views, with the assistance of a couple other sources and Gemaras and thinkers here and there, just to kind of put some pieces together that the Ramban doesn't mention. That is fundamentally how he sees the afterlife, the transition to the afterlife. Again, just to kind of recap, you have this world. This world is both our physical world as well as our period in history, and parallel to this world, you have the Olam HaNeshamot, the world of souls, that is Gan Eden and Gehenim, that is all coexisting right now. Souls leave their bodies to go to Gehenim to be refined of their bad characteristics, to go to Gan Eden in order to pursue God intellectually, in order to understand everything that there is to know, that the nature of our being can possibly fathom, to ultimately be resurrected if you are righteous enough to see the glory of the messianic era, which is in this world, and if you are not righteous enough, to remain where you are, but ultimately to then be brought into or resurrected, depending on whether you are righteous or not, from the messianic era into what is known as the world to come, that the refined characters of each and every individual who are worthy get to experience God in a holistic, emotional sense, to the greatest capacity, the greatest extent to which our being can possibly experience. That is the afterlife according to the Ramban. And in the next episode, I would like to look into the Rambam's perspective on the afterlife.